few means to protest, and they have to engage in the hunger strike battle, especially that many prisoners' terms are renewed for several times, and this without charge or trial. When Radan Far started his protest, he was beaten and tortured by the Israeli jailers, and he was held in solitary confinement.
Palestinians held a protest in solidarity with the prisoners outside the Red Cross Committee building in Ramallah. The oldest of those taking part is 59-year-old, a senior leader of the Hamas movement, Jamal Al-Tawil, joined in protest over the detention of his daughter, journalist Bushat Tawil. He's demanding Israeli authorities to release him and his daughter. Israeli court had extended Bushra's previous administrative detention order last March. There is also Sheikh Khadr Adnan, prominent leader of the Jihad movement, whom is staging his fifth hunger strike. This is the 12th time he has been detained.
Today we are here not only to stand by the prisoners and support them. This is the least we can do against the administrative detention policy. Israel arrests people from all walks of life and different political spectrum. We are in real need to launch a national and worldwide campaign to force Israel stop this policy that exposes the Israeli authorities and their illegal practices.
The Palestinian Prisoners Society said the Israeli authorities have lately increased the use of administrative detention against Palestinians. The committee said Israeli authorities issued 200 administrative detention orders since the beginning of May. The majority of the hunger-striking prisoners are those who are held arbitrarily under Israel's policy of administrative detention. That's why they put their lives on the line to demand not only their freedom, but an end to the administrative detention policy. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea visited South Korea for talks with both his South Korean and Japanese counterparts. Sung Kim then repeated Washington's desire for dialogue with Pyongyang.
Most importantly, we reaffirmed our two countries' shared commitment to pursuing the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula through diplomacy and dialogue. We took note of the recent statement out of Pyongyang regarding their preparation for dialogue, and we hope to receive a positive response to our proposal for a meeting soon.
U.S. President Joe Biden's new point man on North Korea, however, conditioned any negotiations on U.S.-led sanctions against North Korea remaining in place, which many see as a barrier to kickstarting broader denuclearization talks. Some activists suggest the tension provides the U.S. an excuse to deploy troops to the region and support American weapons producers.
The importance of the Korean Peninsula has increased as the U.S. military pressure and response to China has been strengthened. The traditional diplomatic and security establishment of the U.S. wants to maintain a certain level of conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week told officials at a party meeting to be prepared for both dialogue and confrontation. Pyongyang later responded to Washington's offer of talks with ridicule, suggesting a wrong interpretation would lead to disappointment. The U.S. may be paying more attention to North Korea with the appointment of a special envoy in his five-day visit here to South Korea. The question is whether that will translate into greater flexibility from Washington in terms of offering Pyongyang some sanctions relief as North Korea deals with the COVID-19 pandemic and recent natural disasters. Frank Smith, Seoul.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Revelations that Khashoggi's killers were trained by a private security contractor in the States have raised some uncomfortable questions. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Anil Shalin Ryder. This article is published under the heading Saudi bodyguards have been training in the U.S. since Obama. Why? Please stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Four of the 15 Saudis involved in the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi received training in the United States, according to the New York Times. The story highlights the depth of the U.S.-Saudi relationship, the critique of which has simmered following Khashoggi's grisly murder and dismemberment in October 2018. Tire One Group, the security company that conducted the training of the four Saudi men, has stressed that the instruction they received had no relation to the acts of brutal violence they carried out against Khashoggi. Instead, the training was defensive in nature, intended to counter an attack ostensibly against a high-profile individual. This reiterates the link to Mohammed bin Salman, as members of MBS Personal Protection Squad carried out the killing. Although the Saudis continue to deny the Crown Prince's responsibility in ordering the murder. Yet, the revelation also underscores the fact that the problems underpinning the U.S.-Saudi relationship predate the Trump White House as well as Mohammed bin Salman's tenure as Crown Prince. The four Saudis were trained in 2017, but two also received training between 2014 and 2015 while Obama was president and King Abdullah was still on Saudi throne. The question emerges as to why Saudi operatives receive training in the United States at all. The military partnership between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia reflects the country's 75-year-long relationship. Historically, Washington had to overcome the mismatch between Saudi policy and values that the United States claimed to uphold. Democracy, individual liberty, gender equality, freedom of expression, because of American dependence on Saudi oil. Yet the United States surpassed Saudi Arabia as the world's largest exporter of oil in 2019. Instead, the majority of Saudi fossil fuels now travel eastwards to Asian markets. Although the global economy remains dependent on fossil fuels, U.S. willingness to ignore Saudi abuses and crimes can no longer be explained by America's addiction to Saudi oil. Instead, it is the American military-industrial complex that remains dependent on Saudi Arabia as a wealthy and valued customer. Although the Trump administration increased the sale of U.S. weapons by 23%, many of them to Saudi Arabia, the Obama administration sold vast quantities of weapons to the Saudis as well. The Biden administration, after initially committing to end the sale of offensive weapons that could be used to attack Yemen, has allowed certain sales to proceed. At the time of Khashoggi's murder, Congress denounced the Trump administration's close partnership with the Saudis, even passing a historic War Powers Resolution, which Trump vetoed. Yet, since Biden's ascension to power, perhaps because Biden himself initially signaled that he would be tough on the Saudis, critique of their relationship has been more muted. Members need not to have been worried. The Biden administration also has a deep tie to the defense industry. As long as the United States merely pays lip service to the preservation of human rights or only points out abuses by U.S. adversaries while ignoring the crimes of U.S. partners, Biden's efforts to restore America's moral authority will fail. The Biden administration should suspend all arms sales to Saudi Arabia and drastically reduce its military partnership with the House of Saud. Until that occurs, Americans should prepare for more embarrassing revelations about the depth of U.S. and Saudi regime's relationship.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The leader thanks Iranians for their response to the Islamic Republic's call. This is part of a message issued on February 28, 2016, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, following the glorious presence of the people of Iran in parliamentary and the Assembly of Experts elections.
I would like to remind the officials of the country whether the elected candidates for the Islamic Consultative Assembly and the Assembly of Experts, those who have executive positions in other branches or other officials in other organizations and associations, that they should fulfill the obligation to properly thank the people through rendering genuine services to them and to the country and the Islamic Republic. They should consider the following as their permanent plan in this term of responsibility: leading a simple and virtuous lifestyle, being constantly present for one's duty, preferring national interests to personal and partisan aspirations, standing up courageously in the face of foreign interferences, giving a revolutionary response to the plots of ill-wishers and traitors, adopting a jihadi outlook in thinking and in action, and to put it in one sentence, working for the sake of God. Working for the sake of God and in the way of rendering services to God's creatures. They should not violate from these things at any price. Subhanallah, alhamdulillah. Very sensitive times require the sensitivity, vigilance, and firm determination of everyone, you officials in particular. The progress of the country is the main goal. Outward and superficial progress without independence and national dignity is not acceptable. Progress does not mean being digested in the stomach of global arrogance, and preserving national dignity and identity is not possible except with comprehensive and homegrown progress. The future parliament has heavy responsibilities towards these important chapters. We hope that everyone will witness in it the required capacity for being responsive to God and the people. I deem it necessary to sincerely thank the officials in charge of holding these glorious elections, executive and administrative officials, providers of security, the national media organizations, and other influential organizations and personalities. I ask Allah the Exalted to bestow success on everyone. Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration's weapons sales to the UAE is a disastrous move. It puts the U.S. squarely on the side of a serial human rights abuser and inflames a region already awash with way too many weapons. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Media Benjamin and Ariel Gold, anti-war activists. This article is published under the heading, "Why is Biden selling weapons to a country that helped make Yemen a hell hole?" Stay tuned for more. The Biden administration's recent announcement giving a green light to a massive $23 billion weapons sales to the United Arab Emirates makes a mockery of its commitment to put human rights at the forefront of its foreign policy. The Emirates' disastrous roles in Yemen and Libya, along with its vicious human rights record at home, should disqualify it from acquiring advanced weapons. The deal was negotiated under the Trump administration and came to light less than a week after Donald Trump announced the normalization of relations between the Zionist regime and the UAE, known as the Abraham Accords. While the public was diverted with Trump's supposedly brilliant peace initiative, the secret clause that sweetened the deal was leaked. The U.S. would sell billions of dollars of weapons to the Persian Gulf state, 50 F-35 fighter jets, 18 Reaper drones, and various missiles, bombs, and munitions. The UAE and the Zionist regime have never been at war and had maintained unofficial ties for years, but the peace accord allowed the Trump administration to circumvent a policy that requires the United States to guarantee the Israeli regime's military superiority in the region. The Zionist regime's Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu initially feigned outrage that another West Asian country besides the regime would possess the high-tech F-35, but it was soon revealed that the Prime Minister had been in the know from the start and had approved the deal with his own caveat. The Israeli regime would get additional U.S. weapons to balance those going to the UAE. Congressional opponents of the arms deal responded by introducing a bipartisan resolution of disapproval to block the sale. Surprisingly, hawkish Senator Bob Menendez, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, led the resolution with Senators Chris Murphy and Ron Paul. They cited concerns about the timing as a rushed end run around Congress, the UAE's troubling involvement in Yemen and Libya. Though their legislation was voted down when Joe Biden came into office, the State Department put this sale as well as a weapons deal Trump had negotiated with Saudi Arabia on hold. Human rights groups were encouraged that the Biden review might lead to a quashing of the deal, but apparently, geopolitical pressures, the hawks in the administration, and pressure from the weapons lobby have won the day. The companies that stand to gain hefty profits from this sale include Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, General Atomics, and Northrop Grumman. Lockheed Martin will get $10.4 billion selling 50 of its F-35s. According to the New York Times, Raytheon, the biggest supplier of the bombs, lobbied the Trump administration for the deal. Trump's Secretary of Defense Mike Esper was a lobbyist for Raytheon, and Biden's Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is a former Raytheon board member. The UAE's role in Yemen should have been enough to quash the deal. For the past 6 years, the U.S.-supported coalition led by Saudi Arabia has been waging a war in Yemen so brutal that, according to David Beasley, executive director of the World Food Program, this war-torn nation is hell on earth, where one Yemeni child dies every 75 seconds. In 2017, Human Rights Watch and Associated Press accused the UAE of operating secret prisons in Yemen, where prisoners were subjected to horrific forms of torture. Former inmates described cramped conditions covered in feces, being beaten, sexually assaulted, and trussed up on a grill. "We could hear the screams," said a former detainee held for 6 months at the Ryan Airport. "The entire place is gripped by fear. Almost everyone is sick. The rest are near death. Anyone who complains heads directly to the torture chamber," said one former detainee. In addition to its direct involvement, the UAE supported local proxies, around 90,000 fighters, providing them with direct training, capacity building, logistic assistance, and salaries. It also brought in mercenaries from as far away as Colombia, and weapons sold to the UAE ended up in the hands of Al-Qaeda terrorists inside Yemen. Complaints have been filed in the courts in the UK and the US alleging that UAE mercenaries in Yemen committed human rights abuses and war crimes. They also allege that the UAE joined the Saudis in enforcing a naval blockade that has kept fuel, food, and medicines from people in need, committing over 30 fighter jets to carry out airstrikes and naval ships to enforce the coalition's blockade. Anxious to get out of a losing war that has been so bad for its image, the Emirates held a ceremony on February 9, 2020, to mark the end of their involvement in the Yemeni war, moving from a military-first strategy to a peace-first strategy. But humanitarian groups on the ground tell us that the UAE maintains a presence in Saqqarah, Mokalla, and a small presence in Yemen. In addition, it offers financial and military support to a variety of armed groups and political movements that have had a destabilizing influence throughout the country, particularly in the south. Another strike against the sale is that it is fueling the West Asia arms race. While the UAE is set to become the first Arab state to acquire F-35s, it will not be the last. Qatar has already asked to purchase them, and Saudi Arabia will likely follow. The Israeli regime is expecting additional arms beyond the $3.8 billion they already receive annually from the U.S. in military assistance. A final reason is to oppose the deal is the UAE domestic situation. Prince Mohammed bin Zayed is a shrewd West Asian dictator who uses his country's military and financial resources to thwart moves toward democracy and respect for human rights under the guise of fighting terrorism. The UAE restricts freedom of expression and silences dissent. According to Amnesty International, in 2020, despite the COVID-19 pandemic, the UAE continued to detain dozens of prisoners of conscience, including prominent human rights defender Ahmed Mansour. The government keeps opponents under arbitrary detention, and a number of prisoners remain incarcerated despite having completed their sentences. On April 15, 2021, a cross-party coalition of European parliamentarians condemned the systematic crackdown on freedom of speech and expression and called for the release of all prisoners of conscience and an end to torture and ill treatment of these prisoners and the protection of prisoners' families from collective punishment. Another group subject to all kinds of abuses are the millions of migrants who work in Emirates under the kafala system, a type of visa sponsorship system which deprives workers of basic rights. Faced with domestic crises that include a pandemic, a battered economy, and exploding racial tensions, President Biden understands the need to focus his attention on domestic issues and wind down U.S. military entanglements from the past two decades. His recent announcement that U.S. troops will leave Afghanistan by September 11, 2021 reflects this. A $23 billion weapon sales to the UAE is a disastrous move in the Biden administration. It puts the U.S. squarely on the side of a serial human rights abuser and inflames a region already awash with way too many weapons. A new round of legislation by Senators Menendez and Feinstein is being introduced to put checks on the sale of F-35s, but it is the entire sale that must be questioned. If Biden refuses to put domestic and human rights concerns ahead of the profits of weapons manufacturers, then Congress must step and pass legislation to stop it.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, after 6 weeks of indirect talks in Vienna, the gap is still wide between signatories of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Now, according to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, the absence of an interim agreement to monitor Iran's nuclear activities could prompt the U.S. to abandon efforts to rejoin a nuclear deal. While Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Saeed Khatibzadeh has said it is the United States that must make its decision and return to the JCPOA by removing illegal sanctions on Iran and effectively fulfilling all of its commitments. Well, stay with us as we take a look at what it all means and the latest on the JCPOA on this debate. Well, we're going to cross over to Vienna and talk to our correspondent on the ground there, Homa Lesgi, for the latest. Homa, what's going on?
Yes, Marzia, as you said, there are six rounds of talks in Vienna have taken place, and there is speculation that there's going to be a seventh round. We still don't know when that's going to happen. Some are suggesting maybe next week, although the sides have not made any announcement. But as that deadline passed on the 24th of June, the technical understanding between Iran and the IAEA expired. It looks like tensions are rising a bit with the remarks you just mentioned there by the U.S. Secretary of State Blinken. And looking at what was said by the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson and his tweet earlier when he mentioned that it's been Iran that's been giving most of the proposals for in the drafting process, that Iran has this steadfast commitment to salvage the deal that the U.S. torpedoed. Political observers have been seeing this as a sign of Iran's political willingness to get this done. And on the other side, the fact that he said that negotiations can't go on forever, what's also been mentioned by Iran's lead negotiator, Abbas Araghchi here, also signifies that Iran's patience is fading. At the same time, U.S. State Department officials and the Secretary of State himself have signaled that these negotiations can't go on forever. This, however, doesn't mean that they've reached a dead end. Until very recently, and in the last round of talks and in the past few days, various participants in these negotiations, including Iran and the U.S., still believe that an agreement is possible. But how is it going to happen when there are still serious differences, as both sides have mentioned? And these differences both include the nuclear commitments, for instance, the issue of advanced centrifuges in Iran, what is going to happen to them once the JCPOA is in place, also the issue of sequencing, who does what, when, Iran saying that it is not changing its position, that it only will act and go back to full compliance after the U.S. has removed all the sanctions and after Iran has verified that sanctions removal, meaning after it is able to sell its oil and to use the international banking system immediately, something that still it looks like the U.S. is not willing to do that in terms of sequencing. And basically, I think what was said by Secretary Blinken is also noteworthy when he said that it is becoming difficult to go back to the original parameters of the JCPOA because, of course, of the advances that Iran is making in its nuclear program since it started, reducing its commitments when the Trump administration withdrew and imposed the maximum pressure policy. What Iran, however, wants is for all of the sanctions to be removed, not just the JCPOA-related sanctions, but those imposed under the Trump administration under other labels. And is the Biden administration willing to remove all of these sanctions? Is it willing to agree to the sequencing that Iran wants? What is going to happen to Iran's advanced centrifuges? Is a return to the original JCPOA possible? These are still very serious questions that need to be answered, although it looks like, at least up until this stage, that the sides are still willing to continue these talks to see if they can actually reach a conclusion. And we still, of course, don't know when or if Iran is going to extend its technical standing with the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. If that doesn't happen, then the agency will also lose access to the information that's already being collected in Iran and is going to be collected from this stage on.
Thank you so much, Homolinsky, for that update out of Vienna. Now I'd like to welcome to the program founder and executive director of If Americans Knew, Allison Ware, out of Richmond, California. Allison, good to see you. Your take on all of this, Allison. Why is it so difficult for the U.S. to return to an agreement that it says it wants?
Well, the difficulty that this is a domestic issue for the United States rather than an international issue, as it should be. As I suspect you know, and I hope some of the viewers know, what goes on in the U.S. is that really both parties are largely influenced by the Israel lobby and by Israel itself. So in a sense, the U.S. is a proxy for Israel in this case. We have Tony Blinken, who has a lifelong connection to Israel. He helped Israel during its onslaught against Gaza in 2014. And this is the U.S. Secretary of State, who's really, I would consider an Israel loyalist. So the Biden administration, while it is different from the Trump administration on many, many policies in the United States, it has changed. Biden himself and his administration have changed very few policies regarding Israel, Palestine, Iran, and the Middle East in general. So the problem is that, once again, we have the Israel lobby dominating, really, the U.S. policies on Iran. And while for the United States, it would be excellent, you know, Americans want peace with Iran. We don't want all of these Middle East wars. Surveys show that the American public, across the political spectrum, does not want peace wars, does not want this kind of friction and hostility. We have the Israel lobby promoting these kind of policies that really are on behalf of Israel. So I'd say that's the biggest stumbling block to this.
Okay. Well, let me welcome my next guest, Adelise Berg from the Executive Intelligence Review. Bill Jones, thank you so much for being with us. Bill, hopefully you heard what Allison said, that really on the surface, the Biden administration says it wants to do things differently and wants to take a different course than the Trump administration. But the reality on the ground seems to be the opposite, especially when it comes to Iran and dealing with this JCPOA. Your perspective, and if you agree, why is that the reason?
Well, obviously, I think that the United States, probably the Biden administration, would like to have some kind of agreement similar to the JCPOA to prevent a nuclear race in the Middle East, which would be the alternative to that. The question is, are they ready to go back to the table on the basis of the agreement that was signed, which Trump left? It seems to me that there are a lot of caveats that they have there, and that they're really trying, in one sense, to up the ante to actually try and get more than what had been promised and what had been decided on during the former agreements. The other aspect of this thing, of course, or two aspects, is one is the new Iranian government. Are they really prepared to do that as well? This is still not totally clear. But also on the U.S. side, there's a new Israeli government. Now, obviously, they shouldn't be a party to these talks. They aren't a party to these talks. But they are certainly a factor in any decision taken by the U.S. And we really don't know what opinion they have of the JCPOA or even of an extended JCPOA that the Biden administration may be moving toward. And I think a lot of that has to be clarified. And that's why you're seeing a lot of back off and interruptions in getting back to the table and getting back to a deal on the part of the administration here.
Let me see. Allison, can you hear me? Because we did have a little technical difficulties. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Well, Allison, yeah, your overall take. I mean, Iran's foreign ministry is saying that they never left the deal to begin with. So the demand by the United States for Tehran to return to the deal first is actually not logical at all, because they're technically still in the deal. But it was the United States that left it. So in your perspective, where does it go from here?
Well, that's the difficult. It's true that this was the United States had signed what's really an obligatory deal now. It was binding under U.S. constitutional law. So what the Trump administration abandoned the deal, they were actually, I feel, violating U.S. law, certainly the types of things that are considered obligatory under our Constitution. It's difficult now because the Biden administration does want to avoid open hostilities. The deal was actually quite good for the United States. It's beneficial to Israel. It exposed Iran to really intrusive inspections, but Iran, I think, with common sense, did agree to the deal. So now the impasse is I think, once again, sad. I'm a very patriotic American. I have children here and grandchildren here. I want the best for my nation. But I feel that U.S. policies are really damaging the potential for peace, and they're the real problem now in getting another suitable deal that will prevent a Middle East nuclear race. Even though, you know, again, it's never acknowledged that Israel itself has at least 100 nuclear weapons and may have several hundred weapons. So there are already nuclear weapons in the Middle East. That's just never discussed when we talk about Iran.
What about that, Bill? I mean, if we look at this situation, one would think that if the U.S. says that this deal is really effective, which it had said before, we saw the Trump administration said that it was an unfair deal even for the United States. So at this point in time, why do you think that Washington is trying to expand on the original agreement now? I mean, they have tried to include anything from dealing with missile programs to now other centrifuges, advanced centrifuges, of course, and that Iran has worked on after the U.S. left the agreement. So, you know, that Tehran did not go against the agreement. So what's your analysis of all of this?
Well, I think they're hedging because of the fact that there is this, or has been this hiatus in the agreement. And I think there's a real will to get an agreement, but that they're playing hardball in one sense and trying to up the ante before they come and really sign on to a deal. And I think that's causing big problems for getting it back into place. The U.S. did leave the agreement, and in diplomatic terms, if they want to come back, they should come back to that agreement rather than trying to move the goalposts as they're re-entering here. There may also be certain people in the administration who are not happy with that agreement and would like to have a change, but I think that's going to cause more difficulties in getting any kind of an agreement. So you know, if judging from their own national interests, the best thing would be to go back to that agreement if they want to try and work on something else with regard to other questions with Iran. That could very well be discussed in some format. But it seems to me that if they got this in place, that would be a stable basis on which other things could be discussed. But trying to throw it in at the end, at the last minute, to get an agreement, I think it's not going to fly.
Well, Allison, now Iran's foreign ministry has said that the revival of the nuclear agreement is possible if Washington stopped using sanctions as a negotiating leverage. And we know that the Trump administration used what it calls the maximum pressure campaign. But it seems that the Biden administration is using the same technique, although the wording isn't there. They're not talking about maximum pressure, but definitely they're continuing to keep the pressure on. So what is the difference, and what would be the incentive for Iran to even try to continue this when they never kept their word to begin with?
Well, I think for all of us, the best thing would be to have some sort of agreement. Ultimately, that's the bottom line, even if it's as flawed as this one may end up being. I think it's certainly beneficial to have some sort of agreement and not consider continuing this kind of saber rattle. The Biden administration is grappling with the fact that Democrats are now, they're in control of the legislative branch, but it's very close. It's very close. So they have to deal with the fact that Republican Party has been even more captured by the Israel model and will portray any Biden move as overly conciliatory and directed by Iran. So they have to overcome that. They also have to overcome the hawks within the Democratic Party, who've been very powerful, even though the grassroots in the previous election clearly supported people like Tulsi Gabbard and a number of other people that were calling for peaceful types of actions and were not hawks. That's where the Democratic voters were. But the Democratic leadership decided that we would get Joe Biden, who's much more of a hawk, has a long history of being a hawk, and that's now the administration that's in charge. Despite all of that, I expect that the U.S. will finally take some of the actions necessary to procure some sort of deal. I'm unhappy that it's taking them so long to do it. I think they'll keep dithering longer, but I think that eventually something can happen and probably will.
What about that bill, your take? Do you think at the end of the day the U.S. is going to return to the deal?
I think somehow they have got to remain a part of that process and not let that go to hell in a handbasket. And that therefore they're going to have to try to find some kind of compromise that can be acceptable also to Iran for creating and reinstituting the JCPOA in some form.
And Allison, I mean, possible scenarios in your opinion, if a deal is reached, if the United States returns, and on the other side, if it does not?
Well, if it does not, then we have increased tensions and possibly outright warfare, which would be disastrous for, I mean, also disastrous for Americans. I think that is, you know, potentially possible if some sort of deal isn't procured. On the other hand, if there is a deal, it would at least quiet things down a little bit. I think it would help.
And sorry about that, because we're having some technical difficulties with the audio from Allison. But Bill, at the end of the day, how much of an influence do you see Israel is having and putting pressure on Washington to actually continue to try to play hardball and perhaps not even return to the JCPOA?
Well, Israel is obviously not the determining factor. They are a factor that's taken into consideration by this administration, as it was by the former, or most of the former administrations as well. But they're not the determining factor. The basic idea, of course, is the national interest comes first. If Israel feels threatened, there are things the United States can do to ease that with regard to their own supply of military hardware, our alliances that can be strengthened so that the Israelis don't feel threatened by an agreement between the U.S. and Iran and other countries. But I think they are definitely a factor. They'll keep it on the side of their eye to see how the Israelis are reacting. But I think the real problem is the attitude of the administration itself is really that we call the shots, we make the rules, and somehow other countries have got to fall in line with that.
Okay.
And that is the biggest problem.
Okay. Allison, hopefully I can get you 1 minute on this. Your take. You heard Bill that said actually the priority, of course, is national interests come before the Israeli interests. Your take on the influence of Israel in all of this and trying to keep the United States out of this agreement.
Well, influence, I feel, by Israel is pretty much decisive in most cases, sometimes moderated a bit. So it may end up that the U.S. will have to give Israel more money. We already give Israel over $10 million per day. On behalf of Israel, we expend $19 million per day. So to get this deal and keep Israel happy and to get Israel to allow us to make this important deal, we may have to give them, you know, a few hundred million dollars more in weaponry or in other types of military aid. That's how the U.S. may have to buy Israel off so that we can make this deal.
Basically, so the United States would have to pay Israel, almost asking permission, paying them money in order to agree to the JCPOA. Very interesting. Thank you both. Interesting conversation. Talking to, of course, Allison Weir from Richmond, California, if Americans knew, and out of Leesburg, Bill Jones, Executive Intelligence Review. Thank you both. And as always, I appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.